You're good.
Okay, we'll call to order the October meeting for the Town of Curie Beach Planning and Zoning Commission. We had talked about this, we do have an absence, but what we will do is we will kind of ignore that issue right now, and we'll talk about that in our November meeting.
Sharon, let me clarify that a little bit. I see nothing in the statutes regarding any impact on voting one way or another when a member is absent.
Okay.
Number two, if someone knows the reason that that member may be absent, I see no problem entertaining a motion at that time. If no one's privy to the reason for that absence, then it may be, if the commission thinks it advisable, to wait until the next meeting when that member is present and inquire as to the basis at that time and consider and take any action deemed appropriate.
He is traveling for work.
I completely understand that. I mean, a lot of us work. And some of us have a little more flexibility than other people, perhaps, in their work environment. But it also, and, you know, the attorney can, you know, give us advice on this, but we have some very specific rules about attendance. And the rules of attendance last year or 2 years ago were reaffirmed and I think even made stronger by the town council. We had a discussion of this, so that attendance really becomes an important issue. That doesn't mean that we can't excuse people, but there actually is a rule about how many absences you can have. That kind of raises an interesting issue. It's two, right? It's a three and a 12-month period. And I am not sure if excused absences make a bit of difference in terms of that rule.
Well, let's take the big picture. Council can remove members of an appointed board for whatever reason, with or without cause. So you've got that authority. The three strikes you're out is probably set forth in the code. And the rules of procedure require faithful attendance, end quote. The point that I was making is if we routinely excuse and you have a situation down the line that council wants to act on a member's continuing absences.
It actually does say, as used herein, faithful attendance shall be defined as no more than three excused absences in a rolling 12-month period.
Ooh.
So you say excuse, so if you routinely excuse,
technically one could read that an unexcused absence is you're out. You know, that's like a
I don't think that's necessarily an incorrect reading when you recognize that council can remove an appointed member at any time with or without cause.
Yeah. And let me, as a professor, we constantly deal with this issue with students. Okay, that it's not that I don't think anybody wants to remove anybody from a commission. What you want to do is make people aware that we have a rule and try to live up faithfully to that particular rule. So, you know, this discussion is not to kind of point fingers or anything like that. It's just to kind of remind, I think, people that there is an expectation of faithful attendance. And I would say as part of that, is that if we have things scheduled, and particularly if we talk the month before about setting up training and, you know, changing the dates, you know, to accommodate things, and then, you know, again, people get sick, and we all understand that sort of thing, but then, you know, not make it happen. It's just kind of a red flag that I think people need to be reminded about.
So you can do what you want tonight. You can entertain a motion tonight. You can entertain a motion next meeting, or you could not entertain a motion at all. Sounds like you have all the information you need to make a policy decision about those choices. Tranny's traveling for work purposes.
Well, we kind of set a precedent in the first meeting, so I'd kind of like to stick to the same thing right now. Just maybe ignore it for right now and then talk about it next month.
I can put it on the agenda to remember.
Yeah, okay.
Make the motion to excuse them from the last.
Yeah, and
that would provide a good opportunity for discussion on the fact.
Right. When everyone's present to be part of the discussion.
Okay. All right. So we'll just kind of go over that one. Next item is the adoption of the agenda.
Chairman, I do have a comment about
yes.
that. I'd like someone to make a motion to amend the agenda for the purpose of discussing some text amendments to the code.
Okay. I will make a recommendation that we have amend the what's the actual just text amendments to the code?
To new business title being proposed text amendments.
Right.
Okay, so we'll put that as 6.2.
I move that we do that.
Second.
Do we need to vote on?
Yes.
I'll second it. Right.
Okay, it's a second. So we'll put that as 6.2 under new business. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Okay, that was adoption of the agenda with that change. Okay, adoption of the minutes. Since we've all diligently looked at the minutes and sent changes to Beth, I assume there's not a lot of discussion. So is there a motion to adopt the minutes?
Yes, I'll make that motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Public comments. Okay, if there's anybody online, this is the opportunity to perhaps hit star six if you want to say anything to the Planning and Zoning Commission at the present time.
There's still two people on. Okay. I just jailed John.
Since there is a little bit of a delay, I'll wait just a second here. All right, hearing none, we'll go ahead and close the public comments. Old business, land use plan update. Perhaps Mr. Whitley would be the best person to give us a summary.
Still moving forward. We won't have another meeting until, I believe it's December.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And then we'll have a public hearing, whatever, chapter 4 in December. And we will have a public hearing in February for the first five chapters. Nothing exciting has come out of it yet. Pretty standard, straightforward in the first couple chapters. With this chapter, we did more into the policy side of it, so there perhaps might be some more better conversations. But Council Government's doing a great job.
I believe the draft of the chapter 4 is also available. If you haven't gotten
it. Yeah, just a very quick comment. I think it's worked out well. There's been a few contentious points, I think, in the process. But, you know, overall, I think there's, you know, I think the survey turned out very well. I think that there's a lot of insights in it in terms of the growth and some of the demographics of Kiri Beach compared to other communities. And it all looks very, very positive so far. So. You know, it looks like it's moving along very, very well. By the way, those are public hearings, so if anybody, we can have other members attend, I believe, those public hearings. Yeah, okay. So if anybody does want to attend the public hearings for...
Anyone's welcome.
Anybody's welcome.
So PDC members can attend the HPC meetings?
Okay. All right, so anything further on land use plan? Okay, next item is electric vehicle chargers. This is one that I've kind of been bringing up and kind of expanding a little bit. I think everybody has probably gotten an email that I sent last time. And this is just a talking point. We don't need to, you know, make any decisions at all. But what I did is I took my electric vehicle on a trip throughout the Midwest for 10 days. And it was very insightful because what I did is I clearly selected places to go based upon if they had chargers. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, I looked at the various web pages that advertise this. Going Green, I went to communities, I stayed at hotels, I ate at restaurants, and all these sort of things that ended up having, in this case, free chargers. After I got home, I realized that might be a very interesting way to go. So I did some research, and there are a lot of communities. The town of Chapel Hill, for example, has installed probably about 12 or 13 free chargers throughout the town. They're trying to promote it as being green and all these sort of things. And there are actually many towns that have done free chargers as part of not trying to make money. Obviously, you don't make a lot of money if things are free, but as a way of promoting and advertising and getting good press and all that sort of thing. So I thought, well, that's, you know, that's kind of interesting. Other towns charge for it. There's no question about it. So anyway, based upon that, I got kind of some cost quotes last month on, I think it was Charge America and what they would charge and what their network's system was, just as kind of information. I did some checking as to what is the, or who is the major supplier of kind of the poles and the system for free chargers. And I don't have that in front of me. What's the name of the company? That, I wrote it down there. I even put some pictures of it.
Isn't it Electrify America?
No, that was the first one from two. This is.
Is it in your email?
Yes, it is. Clipper Creek.
Yeah,
it's Clipper Creek. And they do, provide very nice systems, fairly cheap. And so if we're talking about maybe two poles where each pole would have a two charger type of system on it, the total cost would probably be $5,000, to have that sort of thing. So it's not a big capital cost. Now, again, these are not network design. They're not the sort of thing you put in credit cards and all that sort of thing. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out. Could you just go ahead and page down? I think I put some, or maybe click on the link there.
The first one?
Yeah, click on the first link.
Should work. It may take a second.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. So you see a lot of these at, for example, I think the one at, the chicken place. What's the chicken place on Monkey Junction?
Chick-fil-A.
Chick-fil-A, yeah. I think Chick-fil-A uses the Clipper Creek systems and all that sort of thing. So, again, as you can see there, $2,300 for a two-point system. This goes on one pole. Somebody comes up and they can get 40 amps of charge. If two people come up, it splits it and they each get 20 amps of charge or something like that.
How long does it take? Like, if I go to Chick-fil-A to eat lunch and I plug in?
These are what are called destination chargers, and they're called destination chargers for a reason versus superchargers. Superchargers, you can charge a whole Tesla in 45 minutes. A supercharger runs on 240 volts, and that probably takes about 4 to 5 hours to go ahead and charge something. That's why they're called destination charger, because people will go, they'll plug in, and they'll go eat or go to the beach or whatever. Hey, you had another question, Jim? I charge because I was out on the highway. I charge with superchargers if I'm trying to get from here to Chicago. But when I spent the nights, I look for destination chargers at hotels. I clearly spent probably $1,000 based upon the $10 that I might save there at a hotel, and choosing hotels that were substantially further distance from where I was planning on going because I felt good that they were appealing to us. And by the way, there are a lot of electric vehicles out there using these chargers. I mean, this is clearly the future. So if you could check on or click on the second link, that's simply the poll, I believe, that goes with this. Yeah, so there's the poll. So $195 for the poll, about $2,500, and that gives you two spaces on one pole right there. So if we were to go with two poles and four spaces, it's probably, $5,300 or something like that. Obviously, the installation charge is not included in this. The closer you are to a 240-volt panel, the better. And so that's why I just suggested out here in the parking space, because you could run over something easily, trench it, probably for a minimal amount of time and money from the fire department or one of those sort of things, where if you're out, out on the street, it might be more difficult to go ahead and put this on. And if you go back to the email, I just have a couple quick pictures. I think one of these is from Chapel Hill, and one is from Eastern Carolina University, I think it is, using this system. So anyway, I have no decisions, but I just wanted to bring this up for kind of continuing discussion as we move into the electric vehicle world, I think, which is happening pretty quick. In fact, be honest, when I got my first Tesla 6 months ago, I think there was only one more on the island. There's probably 20 on the island right now that I've seen. So, I mean, it is definitely coming. I should point out that if we go, whether free or whether we go to pay, this is not going to affect the residents. Any resident's going to charge their own vehicle at their house. This is purely for to attract tourists and as well as publicity. So if you put this in a space that is already a designated parking space, obviously somebody would have to pay for parking if they use this, if it's free. Our parking runs $5 an hour, $20 I think for a day. So These things run about $1 an hour is what the cost of electricity is on these things. So, yeah, I mean, if you think of it that way, you'd actually make money on that particular space if somebody were to come down. During the off season where we don't have paid parking, you know, yeah, then it is free. But I just don't think it'd be probably used that much because I think it'd be more the tourists who would come down and use that. Or if they do come down and use it, it's probably to go visit a local restaurant and spend money. So anyway, it's just a quick discussion point as we kind of push this a little bit further. Yes?
Well, that's my next question. What do you visualize PCC doing with this idea?
I would hope that we would come up with a recommendation to council.
And locations.
Yeah, a recommendation to council and to think about a location. You know, it really strikes me as not a way of making money. I don't think any of these communities plan on making money with their chargers. It's more of an advertising and PR and we're green and all these sort of things. I mean, it's clearly that. And given that the town of Kiri Beach spends a fair amount of money on advertising, that's an intangible. That once that money is spent, it's gone. You know, once that advertisement plays out or once it's been published, we spend about $25,000 to $30,000, I think, a year, if I remember right, on advertising. Is that correct? More than that, right? Where here we're spending $5,000 and perhaps $10 here and there in terms of giving away some free electricity. It's a tangible thing. Those things are sitting out there as chargers, and I think you get a lot of publicity out of it. So I think that's probably the best way to think of it. So anyway, that's just my presentation. No recommendations to do anything tonight on it.
When you do this, is there a website that somebody can go to that... we're coming from Maryland. I want to see where all the chargers are. So when you get this, they automatically designate you as a charger.
There's probably about 10 to 12 different websites out there that will identify all the chargers out there, the type of chargers that are there, and all that sort of thing. And I used it. I got on these websites and I found my hotels because I could find that there was a free charger at that Hampton Inn.
What? Would the town have to initiate that, or is there a group that keeps track of chargers?
There is a group, and I'm sure it'd probably be faster just to let them know. But there's no cost, or anything like that. So, all right. Any further questions or comments? This is just a kind of a continuing discussion, I think. So, yes.
Did you see any charging places that were in parking locations?
I have seen it, not on my trip. They were all in parking lots. Where I went, because I was staying at hotels and eating at restaurants, it was the businesses that it put there. But I do know that Chapel Hill has, and Raleigh does too, yeah. In fact, I've used the destination up in Raleigh.
Wilmington has several charging ports in the last city deck that they've built.
You're right. A lot of them have been city decks. You're right, yes. And those are free, too. The city of Wilmington are free.
Yeah, as far as problem areas, we've only got so many parking spaces. And part of my problem is I can see somebody charging their car, pulling in a parking space, and staying there all day, even after they're charged.
You're right, and that's why I would certainly recommend that if we put a charger out there, we put it in a paid parking place, you know, so that they're paying for the parking. Yeah, they may be getting some free electricity out of it too, but at least we're paying for parking. The other thing you've got to be careful about, and I've seen this, is that if you put the charging in a prime parking place, people who don't have electric cars will park there. And that's called icing, by the way. Internal combustion engine, so it's called icing. When you do that, and it is a big problem, so that's why I'm suggesting that if we do something like this, we do it further away from the beach, because if you put it up right next to the beach, you know, let's say in K Avenue, you know, I guarantee you people are going to park there and not use it. So that's why I was thinking maybe the parking space here at the town hall or something.
Well, I think they, Joseph recommended maybe the
park. I think would
park,
be
yeah
that would probably be another good place. I just don't know how easy it would be to run a 240 there, but it might be pretty simple. Yeah, you're right. You know, and those are already established parking places too, so that might be a natural place to put it. Yeah, so just something to think about, I think, as we kind of push forward on this. But that would probably be my recommendation to go this way versus one of these more complicated pay network type of systems? Because I avoided those. I thought I'd be using those, and I didn't. I never used them once on my trip. So, all right.
My left or wrong.
Discussion of relationship between P&Z and Land Use Plan Committee. Ken, this is your...
Yeah, I tried to attempt this before, and I brought it on the wrong subject. I just want to leave with the thought that if the Land Use Plan comes out and dictates different things... sidewalks, road resurfacings, bike paths, underground utilities. If an ad hoc committee is making a recommendation to the council that affects a deadline or subject in the 10-year plan or the land use plan, I think they ought to, since under 160, we are now the planning organization, correct?
You remain the planning.
Planning, yeah. That we ought to be able to come and be a filter for council to ask questions and make sure that the recommendation is viable within the 10-year plan. So I just thought it would be good for, and ad hoc committees are ad hoc and they're not official. That since we are, I look at the Planning Zoning Commission as being the owner of the 10-year of the land use plan, in a way.
But before Jim mentions things, let me just say I really appreciate you bringing this up, because as we've kind of talked about this, we have, I think, very well established the process, and I think Mr. Eldridge will talk about that. And the process now does include the Planning and Zoning Commission in a very significant way. So
right.
You might want to.
Sure, I'll just make several comments. I think at the end of the day, your concerns are met by the required statutory procedure. When I was listening to your remarks, I imagined an ad hoc committee making a recommendation to council. If that recommendation concerned development regulation, either adding that to the code or amending the development regulation in the code, then there's two or three things that you should keep in mind. One, development regulation under 160D is very broadly defined. It's zoning, it's stormwater, it's building permits, it's the whole shooting match. And you might recall some of that when we were reviewing the text amendments to the code from 160D. Second thing is the statutory procedure for development regulations. Well, let me back up a minute. The chairman was referring to the point that this commission will play a very substantial role in what the land use plan consists of and looks like and provides for, because we will be the filter, this commission will be the filter before it gets to council. Back to the development regulation, keep in mind that PZC is a filter there as well, because any proposed amendment regarding a development regulation first has to be reviewed by PZC before it goes to council, and then council has to have a public hearing on it before they can adopt it or deny it. And then finally, if the recommendation by an ad hoc committee ends up being a proposed amendment to a development regulation that impacts Chapter 15 zoning, then the additional step of PZC adopting a consistency statement and council adopting a consistency statement, said statements reflecting on whether the proposed amendment is consistent with the land use plan. Those are additional steps. And then finally, 160D also provides that if council takes an action that is it's probably limited to Chapter 15 in zoning. If council takes an action on a zoning amendment that it finds, or that possibly DZC finds, is inconsistent with the land use plan, then by statute, without doing anything else, the land use plan is amended to allow for that inconsistent change.
Okay. So,
okay. I hope I was clear and all that.
So, the bottom line is, I think your concern, which was a legitimate concern, will the fact that the land use plan will come to the Planning and Zoning Commission for our review prior,
right,
before it goes to town council, I think probably satisfies your concern.
Okay.
And if an ad hoc committee comes up with something down the line that's inconsistent with LUP, with the land use plan, it has to take, more likely than not, the form of a development regulation. DZC will weigh in on
okay.
that development regulation in light of the LUPC.
Just... Okay.
No,
that's for them in the future. I just wanted to put it out there.
Your legacy is secure.
Oh, God.
All right.
Thank you.
We have two. I forgot that we had a 6.2 geospatial mapping. If it's okay, let's go ahead and do the 6.2, as we said, the text amendment, and then 6.3 will be geospatial mapping.
You want me to go now?
Yeah. Yeah, let's go ahead.
Let me find it on my pad. Two things. One, very briefly, we're, thanks to the North Carolina General Assembly, and Beth Beers will perk up on this, we're entering into another comprehensive revision of the town code from top to bottom. What the General Assembly did was decriminalize, when you enforce an ordinance, and of course we have the code of ordinance, you can enforce them criminally or civilly or both. And other than parking and infractions, I realize that most of our enforcement actions are civil. Nonetheless, the code is replete with provisions that provide for criminal enforcement as well. What the General Assembly did, effective December 1 of this year, was to decriminalize a lot of ordinance enforcements, and not only that, they provided a checklist of about 20 items that cannot be enforced criminally. So bottom line is, we're going to have to comb the, and I'll be working with Chief Allen on this, we'll comb the code from top to bottom, identify which of the provisions are, which of the provisions allow for criminal enforcement, and rule them out and delete that provision if it's on the checklist of ordinances that cannot be enforced criminally. And what will be left with are those provisions which can be criminally enforced, and we'll work with DCC, Chief Bowden, and Council to identify when, if any time, Council wants to enforce things criminally other than parking.
So that means we can't put people in jail if their porch lights are too bright?
Yeah, that's right.
Sure. To report it.
Have we had any action on the light?
No, it's all complaint driven. I don't think John has had any complaints yet, which is fine, but it's, you know, at least we have it in place.
So can I ask a question though? Mm-hmm. As I understand it in chapter 15, all of the penalties, all of the infractions would receive a civil penalty.
Yeah, I think our 160D amendments, I've got to double check to make sure nothing in there is criminal, but my recollection is that we made all those things civilly enforceable.
So in which case, it's kind of like a little light for P&Z, because these changes won't really affect what we do, right? Because we mostly deal with chapter 15.
I guess what I'm saying, well, any, you got your code, chapters 1 through whatever, 15, 16, 17. A lot of those chapters are development regulations. And and DZC has to weigh in on proposed amendments to development regulations, whether they're just 15 or whether they're stormwater or whether they're under Chapter 11 for building permits. So my job is to find wherever in the code we have a criminal enforcement provision, and if it requires an amendment to the code and that amendment deals with the development regulations, we'll be taking that up as well, in addition to any Chapter 15 similarities. For example, if I go into the code under Chapter 11 and I find that a violation of a provision dealing with a building permit is both criminally and civilly enforceable, then I'll go back to the session law that was just adopted, and I'll probably find that building permit is an item on the checklist that cannot be criminally enforced. So therefore, I have to amend the code, Chapter 11, to rule out criminal enforcement, and that amendment can come to you to review before it goes and recommend proposals of the council.
But if it clearly states in Chapter 11 that the penalty for an infraction for Chapter 11, if it clearly states that the penalty will be a civil penalty, then nothing has to be changed.
I know I'm correct, but I know that I'm going to find instances where I've got the possibility of criminal enforcement when the legislature has just told me I cannot do that.
I assume you'll come to us kind of as a lump, you know, find all those, and we'll just come.
It won't be as bad.
Right, because I assume we don't have a lot of choice if the state has already said we can't do it. So,
and again, I'll be working with the chief. And Beth, I think the chief's given you something. If you could go ahead and forward that to me. Anything else on that particular matter?
No, that's fine.
Let's switch gears and go to quasi-judicial for a moment. I worked with Wes for some time this week, coordinating his training session. We wanted to make sure it wasn't redundant with what I did. And he's worked up a good product. In the course of coordinating with Wes, we ended up focusing on an issue. The issue is basically the unauthorized practice of law. He alerted me to an ethics opinion. Let me back up. The state bar, which licensed attorneys to practice law in this state, has codified a set of ethical rules called professional responsibility. And from time to time, they issue advisory opinions on those ethical provisions or those ethical obligations. That's point one. Point two, Chairman, you probably have experienced this. I'm not sure, and Mr. Duca, you may have as well, but it's, now, I certainly have, not when I was representing municipalities, but when I was attending Board of Adjustment hearings. I've seen architects come in, I've seen engineers come in and present their client's case for a variance. Beth may be an architect, I may be the landowner. The architect has noticed something is wrong and we can't proceed forward unless we get a variance. Beth may actually file that application. Beth presents the case to the Board of Adjustment in this hypothetical. I'm sitting next to her, or I may not even be present, and she presents the opinions and the witnesses if there are any. Well, this opinion 2006-1 that's up on the screen basically says that those professionals are engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, that the only individual that can present a case on behalf of an applicant is an attorney. Mm-hmm. And that's because quasi-judicial has legal procedures, have legal aspects to it. And that engineer that comes in or that architect that comes in and is trying to persuade them to do the decision-making board to do something for their client is engaging in the practice of law. The consequence, and that would be a violation of this statute, and you can see the highlighted part, it shall be unlawful for any person or association of persons except active members of the bar for or without a fee or consideration, to give legal advice, and here's the key, perform for or furnish to another legal services. So again, that architect appearing before a board of adjustment for their client is performing legal services. So the consequence of that is a criminal violation, a class one misdemeanor. That, so that got me thinking. And here's the hypothetical scenario. I do not, as a general rule, and I'm usually very ironclad about this, I do not advise or counsel a decision-making board like BOA or HPC on quasi-judicial hearings, because I don't want to end up being a witness, I don't want to end up being part of the record, so I stay aloof. I may facilitate the conversation, but I stay aloof and separate from that conversation. So a situation could arise where if I'm not going to say anything and we have an architect that has submitted an application for a COA, or we have an engineer, a developer, a contractor who's seeking the variance so that they can finish the house for the client and get the certificate of occupancy, that could show up in front of HBC, or that could show up in front of council for a special use permit, or that could show up in front of a board of adjustment. And if I'm sitting silent, then it would be up to that board to recognize or recall or remember what we just got finished talking about. In other words, I'm not going to be able to raise my hand and say, Chairman, this person's engaging in the unauthorized practice of law. You all figure out what to do about that. That's not a fair burden to put on you all, because I don't think it's going to, for all you know, you might just miss that issue. I'm not making a discouraging remarks. But that issue might go over a decision-making board's head. Worse, if it was missed, and the hearing proceeded and we had a decision, then you can see the kind of complications we'd be getting into. The point being, when I looked at the code, I saw these two things. 1206.050D, the applicant, the town, and any person who would have standing to appeal the decision shall have the right to participate as a party. I think that captures it, but barely. If you look at 1508080, that's a special use permit. Applications for a special use permit shall only be submitted by the landowner or duly authorized agent. That actually kind of sets the stage for the problem that I'm talking about to happen, because I may have authorized Beth to act as my agent, and then she comes in as the architect and presents the case, which is, by statute, in ethical opinion, wrong. I want to go back and amend 1206050D, which sets forth the quasi-judicial procedures that need to be followed by any decision-making board for an evidentiary hearing, which is HBC for COAs, Council for Special Use Permits, BOA for Variances and Appeals. I want to add a new paragraph, or probably a sentence after this highlighted first part, that makes it clear that other than an attorney acting on behalf of the applicant or the appellant in a quasi-judicial procedure, other than being represented by an attorney, that the applicant or the appellant has the burden of presenting their case. Kind of hard to give you an example right now, because this all just came up the last couple of days. But I want a sentence or two to make it clear that when a decision-making board in a quasi-judicial proceeding comes face-to-face with an architect, for example, trying to present their client's case, then they'll have the benefit of the code provision in black and white that they can fall back on rather than having to remember that on October the 13th, Mr. Eldridge presented a presentation, that that's another.
Let me ask one question, because this has got me a little bit concerned. And hopefully we're not going to deal with anything complicated that would end up in a lawsuit, but your statement that you kind of will remain a little bit silent, would it make sense that when we go into a quasi-judicial hearing, that counsel authorizes a different attorney to act as the attorney for that particular situation?
That does happen from time to time, and
who wouldn't have a problem raising their hand, because that's what they would be hired to do in that particular situation, to remind us to follow the appropriate processes.
Well, I've seen that happen, and frankly, even after 30 years of practice, I'm still a little confused by that, because I still think that that runs the risk of, you know, if I'm the applicant and I'm turned down because of something that that outside counsel told you all to do, I might try to make a claim on that because it affected. If my client can't proceed forth, I think it presents problems. That's one way of approaching it. I've seen it happen. We can certainly entertain that. But I still think it would be useful to have a clear sentence in the quasi-judicial section of the code that says, unless you're represented by an attorney, it's your burden to present your case, call your witnesses, and provide evidence.
Okay. Yeah, I hopefully we're not going to get into this, but, you know, but we may. I guess the role of the HPC in a quasi-judicial hearing, it's my understanding that we're more acting as the court, the judge in the court.
That's correct.
Okay.
Judge and the jury.
Where judges obviously are trained and certified attorneys. I mean, they know the rules, but we aren't. Okay. Now, we may have rules that we can look at. We may have had training and all that sort of thing, but that certainly doesn't bring us to the level of your expertise and your experience. I guess I'm just a little concerned, and I can see things probably more as an issue in the Board of Adjustments, that there isn't the representation of the attorney for the town. You know, because you're not going to act in that role, as you said. You know, who can answer the question? I mean, to answer the questions, you know, should I say this? Should I do this? Because we're not, you know, I mean, we're not judges up here. I mean, we try to be, but we're really not.
Well, let me do some homework. My inclination is to have the code provided. I'm not completely silent in those hearings. I facilitate matters quite a bit, but I don't offer opinions. I don't want to raise my hand and say, I think Ms. Chase is engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, or that you may want to inquire whether Ms. Chase is engaging in the unauthorized practice of law. I see problems with that down the line. It's much easier for me to say, hey, if you look at 1206.050D, you'll see a sentence in there that the applicant, unless represented by an attorney, has the responsibility for presenting their case. So you may want to ask Ms. Chase how she intends to proceed, and you may want to consider whether that party needs a continuance in order to comply with that provision of the code. I'm not offering advice there. I'm pointing to something black and white.
I'm a little maybe highly sensitive. I'm sure everybody knows I do consulting in legal litigation type of situations, and I'm working with an attorney right now on a situation, and he does class action lawsuits representing developers. I just found out this, and they just won a $73 million lawsuit against Charlotte. Yes. It's going to go to the Supreme Court, but for a minor mistake that Charlotte has been making over the last 20 years that has impacted dramatically the developers, and they brought a class. Yes. So I am sensitive to these, even though this is a small type of situation, we're probably not going to have anything like this. I am sensitive to possibilities of lawsuits that could be quite impactful for a small town like Kerry Beach.
Well, let me do two things. Let me call some of my colleagues and explore further the role of outside counsel in these matters. But also, let me go ahead and draft a sentence or two along the lines that I've recommended, and we'll bring it forward next month, and you all can decide if you want to pass that on to council or not.
Yeah. I mean, again, I agree with Kathleen that, you know, it's probably not going to be a big issue here in the town of Kerry Beach. And it's probably a much bigger issue in Charlotte or places like that where they have multi-million-dollar developments. But it is something to be concerned about.
It's a matter of scale. Perhaps $73 million is a lot for Charlotte, but $60,000 or $70,000 in attorney's fees would be a lot for Kerry Beach.
I do have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
So we have a property owner who wants, whatever, is having a Board of Adjustment hearing. And he's presenting his case to the Board of Adjustment under a quasi-judicial hearing. He also has his architect with him, and he presents his case and then asks his architect to give technical information.
That's entirely appropriate. He's calling.
I mean, that's what I see happening in these hearings. Like, that's how it would go.
Yeah, that's how it should go. But I've seen occasions where the architect runs the whole show, and that's wrong. The applicant doesn't even say.
So the architect's not a witness, but rather.
I understand, but the way it's written now, doesn't it say that it's the property owner who has to,
As I said during my comments, I think the top highlight covers it, but I just wonder whether an additional sentence that makes it very clear that unless you're represented by an attorney, it's your burden to carry the. It may be that, you know, I'm comfortable with 1206050D, but it's not the clearest expression of that. That's the only thing I'm suggesting. You think we need a clearer.
Yeah, you know, if you want to propose an additional sentence, I think that's fine.
And I'll let me do some homework on the outside counsel.
Okay.
That's something I've always wanted to get a better handle on.
Do you have
any comments about outside counsel? I mean, I know you've got some experience in these matters.
The only comment I would make would be quasi-judicial. Being on counsel, the counsel would be judicial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll do some homework and come back.
Okay, very good. All right.
Thank you.
All right, last one is the geospatial mapping. Again, I think I mentioned this in the land use development. We had a discussion of land use development, and it came up that, they're talking about maps, and, I've worked kind of extensively with the geospatial mapping group at UNCW, and I thought, well, shoot, man, it might be some interesting things. I've been communicating with a graduate student who is the graduate assistant there at the geospatial mapping group at UNCW, and she wrote actually a very good email. I think I passed this on, not to the P&Z, but I think it went to the land use plan, where she detailed. Okay. So anyway, I invited her to see if she'd be interested in coming to the P&Z and doing a presentation. And she is. But unfortunately, she just had a death in the family. So I didn't schedule it for this time. But if it's okay with the commission, I'll see if she could do it in our November meeting. If she can, I'll tell you, Beth, and you can put it on the agenda then, if that's okay. There's a lot of fascinating things they can do with drones and satellites and stuff like that now that we might find useful. So, and I think the last item is then, this is Ken's last meeting.
Yep.
So again, I want to thank Ken for his, how many years has it been?
It's been six, I guess.
6 years, wow.
And I wanted to say thanks to Joseph. I mean, he's been a counsel to me. Thanks to Beth.
Thank you to Ben Hendricks.
Yeah. No, it's all been good. And to to Jim, who's always helped me at the beginning and all, and to Mandy, tell her thanks.
Hello.
And it's been a great thing. I've enjoyed it. We've done everything from parking to container homes to arguing about bike paths. So it's all been good. So and I've enjoyed it. I'm going to miss it, but it's time for, I would think it's always good to get new people in, and so it's time for somebody else to come and present their view of Curry Beach, and I think that'll work out great.
We got a lot of things done while you were on.
Yeah, we did. I think it was a very active time. And
remember exotic animals?
Yes.
Actually, I forgot about that one. Yeah, they were the exotic animals too. So it's, as long as we didn't have any exotic.
Okay.
Hold yeah, on. Never mind. Stop. Don't go any further. Yeah, but I've enjoyed it. And thank you all.
Well, thank you.
Ken. Yeah.
Good job.
Much.
Okay, thank you. Right. But that then brings us to the idea of advertising for another, an alternate bait. Yeah. Okay.
So can I ask, since we already had interviewed Byron Ashbridge, and it's been within a year, is his status such that we can now offer that position to him? Because we...
He withdrew, didn't he, from...
No, I think he was only interested in PNZ.
PNZ.
I believe so.
He is still interested.
In PNZ, so, okay.
I mean, so can we make it... Excuse me?
You interviewed him at the board?
We did. We did when we interviewed Joe, and there was another.
And Garrett.
Oh, yeah.
And Garrett. It's been a year.
Yes.
You can appoint him.
So that can make it very simple.
Now, he's also technically then appointed to the HPC.
Yes, correct.
Okay, because the alternate to PNZ is a full voting member of the PNZ.
That person will fill that spot as well.
Yeah. Okay, would he be willing to do that?
He
wasn't interested in being only HPC. When my thought was, well, the person from
HPC. Why don't we reach out to him and would you like him to come to the November meeting?
Yeah, I think that'd be appropriate. Yeah, to see if he's still interested because the appointment would be as an alternate member to PNZ and a full voting member to HPC. Okay.
See what he says on that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, because that would cut out a lot of time with advertising.
Yes.
And one more thing I forgot to thank is Craig. you've been great, and I know you stepped in when John Allen was here, and you were it, then you weren't it, and then you were it again. And you have done a great job as chairman, and I know it's a burden on you, but I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah,
thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's been great having you. So, all right, is there a motion? I'm going to let you can do the final motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn.
Okay, very
second.
Good. All in favor say aye.
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 Great. Right. Well, thank you. Well, good. You might shake.
Well, you did it, Ken.
All right. Good job.
See you later.
Okay, Ken.